Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. One big helper on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton, bigger than most people realize she would be, is Michelle Obama. In the waning days of the Barack Obama presidency, the First Lady is at the peak of her popularity. Her convention speech was amazing, and her star power grew again last week, if that was even possible, with her heartfelt reaction to the Donald Trump Access Hollywood video and women coming forward to corroborate his claims of unwanted touching.
And I have to tell you that I can't stop thinking about this. It has shaken me to my core in a way that I couldn't have predicted.
Now, this Sunday's New York Times Magazine will have a collection of short essays celebrating Michelle Obama called To the First Lady with Love. One of them is by historian and former Newsweek editor-in-chief John Meacham. His most recent book, just out in paperback, is a political biography of George H.W. Bush called Destiny and Power. Hi, John. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
You wrote about Michelle Obama that she has chosen her shots carefully. You don't just mean in this campaign, but throughout her career as First Lady, right?
Really remarkable, absolutely. You know, there are a couple of models for First Ladies. There's the Eleanor Roosevelt, Nancy Reagan, Hillary Clinton model, where one is more active overtly and covertly, too, sometimes, in Mrs. Reagan's case, in public policy and personnel. Then there's a more symbolic role, Mrs. Nixon, for instance. And, you know, what Mrs. Obama has done, and I really think at least I didn't appreciate it until recently, is picked her opportunities to step on the public stage and has become, as you just suggested, an incredibly effective voice in really discussing this breakdown of convention, breakdown of political normalcy, which in many ways is totally fascinating, given that she is the first African-American First Lady. She is someone we're going to be studying and thinking about forever in the same way we are about her husband. And I think she quite brilliantly decided when to expend her capital and when to just be a mother. And I think if I were going to be the first spouse at any point, she would be probably my first phone call.
You even write, and sad but true, I guess, you write that she did what the first African-American First Lady had to do, never appear to threaten or intimidate her neighbors. Now, that's a line that's going to be very familiar to Black Americans. In that they have to walk it in white society in all kinds of ways. Did you mean it in that way?
I meant it that in the same way President Obama has always been incredibly careful not to appear overly emotional, even angry from time to time in public. She had the same issues. I think that the president himself has occasionally erred on the side of appearing cool, clinical, in some ways more detached than I believe he in fact is to the emotional and political life of the country, because he realized that there was this sometimes subtle, sometimes, as we've seen in this campaign, not so subtle, white anxiety in some quarters about powerful African Americans. And I think that Mrs. Obama, in many ways, was working within the same template. And I do know, for instance, that one of the things about Mrs. Obama and the Trump problem is, let's remember how Donald Trump really made his most recent national foray. What started this off? The birther movement, right? He rose to this particular place in the last 5 or 6 years by arguing that the president of the United States was not, in fact, an American citizen. And I know from people who are fairly close to Mrs. Obama that that was particularly upsetting understandably, to her. It had implications for her daughters. It had implications for her family's safety. And I think she has very subtly and very effectively proven that payback is a dish best served cold. And she's gotten her full measure back at Trump in these wonderful speeches you just mentioned.
John, why do you think both Obamas are riding high in the polls now, while the public seems to think the country is going in the wrong direction?
Great question. Part of it is, I think, presidents almost always, not always, but almost always, tend to start looking better when the farther removed they are from the partisan passions of the moment. So, for instance, George Herbert Walker Bush, about whom I've just spent a long time thinking and writing, almost immediately when he lost to Bill Clinton in 1992, his approval ratings started going up. And he actually left office with a higher approval rating than he'd had in a long time.
But not George W. Bush. Not George W. Bush.
Not George W. Almost always. But also that was a particularly cataclysmic time economically and with Iraq.
Yes. So
that was a hotter moment. I think part of it is there's something, and it drives politicians crazy, and I understand it. There's something in the American political psyche that always wants what we don't have and values what's going away as opposed to what's coming. And I think that, I interviewed President Obama once and I said, you know, people say you're Spock, not Kirk. And he held up his hands in the live long and prosper sign and said, you got that right. and so I think we're going to, you know, we're in an era of, with Trump, with this raw emotion, not particularly rational, we're really, I think, enveloped in what Richard Hofstadter 50 years ago called the paranoid style in American politics. Yeah. And while we have a Republican nominee who's out there stoking emotions, who's not being rational, who is making very few fact-based arguments, I think the clinical President Obama is going to look better and better.
Your book, Destiny and Power, now out in paperback, is about George H.W. Bush. Word leaked out that he plans to vote for Clinton. Are you surprised?
He does. A little bit, yeah. It's his first Democratic nominee to ever vote. He's never voted for one. He voted for Dewey in 1948 and Republican nominees all the way through. He's 92 years old. But, you know, in 1988, Lee Atwater actually had some conversations with Trump and came to Vice President Bush at that time and said that Trump was willing to be considered for vice president in 1988. And in his vice presidential diary, Bush said, strange, unbelievable. It just wasn't part of his fact set that he could consider that. And I think it has very little to do, for those who think that this is all familial, I think it has much less to do with the fact that Jeb Bush did not do well in the primaries. I think that Trump is beyond the pale of what George H.W. Bush thinks should be in the White House.
Last question. For you as a historian, what do you think of Trump suggesting he might not accept the election results as certified by the states? Is there any precedent?
Well, no, and I'm a biographer of Andrew Jackson, too. So just to take you back for one quick second, 1824, Jackson wins the popular vote but loses in the House of Representatives. I'm not sure what it is about my fellow Tennesseans. This has happened to us twice now with Jackson and with Gore. Jackson, on the night he lost the election in the House as the result of what he believed to be a corrupt bargain between Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams, he appears at the White House at one of Louisa Catherine Adams's levees, one of her receptions, walks up to John Quincy Adams and says, Mr. Adams, how do you do, sir? He's incredibly gracious in public. He's outraged privately and immediately begins running in 1828. But notice what I just said. He began running for the next election. He didn't try to undermine the result of the constitutional process. And so, no, there's not really a precedent. And I must say, if I may parenthetically, the kind of the pundit talk, the Trump surrogate talk last night and into today, that what Trump said has an analogy with what Al Gore did in 2000 is totally factually, historically wrong. Al Gore conducted himself with enormous grace. He obeyed the constitutional order. The Florida recount was mandated. And to try to grab Gore out of a dignified place in history and use him to justify Trump's chaos theory of national politics is beyond the pale, I think.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was thinking a lot about the same thing, that what Gore did was engage in a legal process. And that's not what the question was from Chris Wallace last night. Once the legal process concluded with the 5-4 Supreme Court ruling ending the Florida recount, Gore disagreed with the ruling but immediately accepted the legitimacy of the election. We're talking about what Trump would do at that point if he still disagreed, right?
Absolutely. And to bring this full circle, the night Gore gave that speech after the Supreme Court ruled, George H.W. Bush was watching from Houston. He saw that Gore was leaving the old executive office building. He reached out to an aide. He said, I'd like to speak to Gore. Can you find the vice president for me? He reaches Gore. Gore's in his limo, getting ready to go back to the vice presidential residence. And Bush, the father of the man who's become president, his first call that night was to Al Gore to say how impressed he was by his grace, by his dignity in that moment. As he put it, he said to Gore, he said, I know what it's like to lose. You know, Gore had beaten him, right, in 1992. And, you know, I feel as though I'm describing Thermopylae. Right. I mean, here you had a moment where you had grown-ups who believe in the constitutional order, who believe in the great democratic process that's kept us going for almost 250 years, and commensurate with the stakes of the hour.
John Meacham, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his 2008 biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion, is an executive editor at Random House. He was the editor-in-chief of Newsweek, and his book, just out in paperback, is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We continue in a minute.